Hi everyone.
Welcome to another episode of the Cheeky Natives. It's Letlhogo Nolo flying solo. Today I'm bringing you a very special conversation. This conversation was recorded for the Open Book podcast series. This conversation will be with Brandon Taylor, who wrote Real Life, which has been shortlisted for the Booker Prize, and Paul Mendes, who wrote Rainbow Milk, a debut novel that has been critically acclaimed.
I grew up with a lot of shame, and a lot of it was predicated not so much on like my queerness as like what my family perceived as like gender deviancy. You know, like if I put a towel on my head and pretended I had long, luxurious locks.
You did that too?
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
Hello, friends. Welcome to the Open Book podcast series, where we bring you important and fascinating conversations between local and international authors. I'm Fasti Collitz, and I'll be listening along with you. In this episode, Brandon Taylor and Paul Mendes are in conversation with Letlhogo Nolo Mokgoroana, who is one half of the amazing literary podcast, The Cheeky Natives. Brandon Taylor's debut novel is Real Life, which is the story of Wallace, a young black PhD student at a mostly white campus in the Midwest. Most of the novel takes place over the course of a weekend, tracking his relationship with his classmates. In particular, he has a series of sexual encounters with one of them, the supposedly heterosexual Miller. This exceptional novel was very deservingly shortlisted for the Booker Prize 2020. Paul Mendes's novel is also a debut, called Rainbow Milk. Like Paul, the protagonist Jesse is a Jehovah's Witness who is disfellowshipped for being gay. He moves from the black country to London, where he works as a sex worker. These novels intimately inhabit the experiences of protagonists that feel alienated because they are black in overwhelmingly white spaces and queer in straight spaces. But they are also novels about the possibility of finding tenderness and connection in those spaces. This conversation took place from three different continents, with Brandon in Iowa, Paul in London, and Letlhogo Nolo in Johannesburg. And yet, the three of them found that they had many shared experiences. And the result is a lively, intimate, and actually just completely delightful conversation. Just a quick note, this episode contains some strong language. So if you're listening around children, consider listening on headphones. Here it is.
Hi, everyone. I wanted us to start the conversation here to think about location as a literary device. I think both Rainbow Milk and Real Life play at different locations, geographically, but also positionality. What was the thinking behind using location in this sense?
Well, I think migration is a story that, you know, is absolutely central to Black life. You know, you start the book with a Jamaican immigrant to the UK in the 1950s as part of the Windrush generation, which, you know, I am descended from that community. I'm, you know, the third generation from that community. But it wasn't really until I became an adult and started reading books by the likes of Andrea Levy and Sam Selvan, Small Island in particular, and The Lonely Londoners, that I realized that my grandparents in the 1950s had actually done those things, but they were much less keen on talking about it. Perhaps they just didn't feel empowered to, perhaps they didn't have the tools, perhaps they wanted to forget. So I sort of didn't really grow up with any real sense of my identity in that respect. It's really only through fiction that I can sort of take the facts that I know about and then create a world around them. And so that's what I did. But then, obviously, the baton then switches to Jesse at the start of the 21st century. And his is a migration as well, because he's moving from a very provincial part of the country, a very industrial part of the country, to cosmopolitan London, where for the first time he's meeting people from all over the world, hearing different languages, different accents, hearing people speak about different things. And that is also a migration. You know, I suppose the American equivalent would be the migration from the south to the north that happened early in the 20th century. So, you know, it's all fascinating, this kind of idea that you can be in one place and think you know yourself, but then you can move to another place and become a completely different person because of what that place opens up to you and what it does to you.
Thank you so much. Brandon, I think about location playing a sort of break from the past. And I wanted to talk to you about geographic location and its place in the book and how it's used in the book.
Yeah, I mean, Wallace ends up leaving the South and going to the Midwest because he's trying to physically outpace his past and his family and his circumstances. And he's really bought into this idea that, like, by changing his location, he can sort of get up and out of, like, the horrible confining circumstances of his life. And what he finds is that he cannot sort of outpace those constrictions by leaving the South, because those constrictions are everywhere. They're sort of systemic. They're in the air. You can't outrun white supremacy is what he finds, essentially. And you also can't outrun your trauma, because trauma very much resides within you and within yourself. And so I was interested in sort of teasing apart this question of, what happens when you leave home? What happens when you try to make a physical break with the past as a way to sort of make an emotional break with the past? And I was also very much interested in writing about what it's like to be a Southerner displaced into the Midwest, because we often think of the Midwest as being more progressive than the South, or more quote unquote accepting, you know? And so I think that, you know, the novel is turning over this idea of, like, what things are easier when you leave home and what things are just as hard and what things are more difficult. And what Wallace finds is that while it's easier in many ways to be quote unquote himself in this new place, what he finds is that, like, his race, like his blackness, like one of them, like, in, you know, sort of obvious things about him, like that becomes so much more complicated in ways that he never experienced at home. And so, you know, he's traded one kind of agony and suffering for another. And that was very much played out because he has, like, left home for this whole other place to sort of be among strangers.
I like the fact that you speak about the idea of race, because I think that Wallace and Jesse both remind us different strats of race and the precarity of blackness, right? We find Wallace being in the Midwest in this institution on this campus and having these white friends, right? And we find Jesse sort of, you know, being raised by this white father. And because he's raised by this white father, it seems the attractions, the feelings that he has to white men are like authority, but also some form of attraction, because Jesse cannot believe that in many ways that black people exist in the way that he wants them to exist, because he hasn't experienced that life. And I wanted to speak a bit about that, right? The idea of blackness playing at different roles. Here you have Wallace, who is someone who is, like, black and is acutely aware of his blackness because of the environment that he's in. Here you have Jesse, who's sort of trying to find blackness, but not, there's no space for him to find that blackness, because that's not the community in which he grew up in, largely because he was raised by Graham, who is white. And I wanted to speak about what was that? What were you trying to, you know, convey by having these characters experience blackness in this way?
Do you want to go first, Brandon?
Sure. What I was interested in doing was playing out the particular drama of a character who was raised within a black family in a very black part of the country, whose sort of primary axis of the world was, like, black people. So, like, when he, like, leaves that point of reference and goes to the Midwest, even though he never felt quite at home among his family, he realizes just how black he is. You know, he realizes just how black his point of reference is. And so he's like, oh, all along I thought that I had this very strange relationship to my blackness, but I am in fact incredibly black. And, like, what I took to just be the common underlying structure of the world is, like, a deeply black structure, because the people who raised me, you know, were black. And so what he finds once he's out among white people who he thought he might have greater affinity with, he realizes, like, oh no, like, we are not the same. Like, we aren't approaching from the same point of reference. Like, he finds himself estranged in ways that he never imagined. And he finds his blackness emerging into a way that he can see. And of course that makes sense, because when you're Black and you're just among Black people, you aren't thinking about your Blackity-Blackness, you're just being. And it's when you enter into a space in which that Blackness is marked out for you, you can't help but to notice it. And so for Wallace, the vertigo he experiences is having his Blackness marked out and pointed out, and he's like, oh right, like this is what it is. And I feel like that's often not what I experience when I read literature by and about Black people. Is like, often they sort of take it for granted that like this character's Blackness is so rock solid and is so so clear to them. And I'm like, no, like sometimes you are Black and you don't realize it until someone's like, hey, Black boy, they sort of point you out and you're like, oh. And so I was interested in sort of trying to put my finger on like, what is that peculiar sense of, you know, like realizing, oh, I was Black all along, and then being like, oh, of course I was Black all along. What else would I have been? And not just like the horrors of that, but also like the funny moments of being like, yeah, I am so incredibly Black and had no idea, because I thought everyone in the world, you know, had the same set of references. So that's what I was interested in sort of trying to tease apart in the novel.
I totally agree with the sort of sentiment that sometimes you forget that you're Black. Sometimes you're in a room and you're in a room full of white people, and because you didn't see yourself there, you look down at your hand and you can see that it's brown, but like at the same time, you know, you're not sort of othering yourself until someone does it for you. And, you know, I think Jesse, because he's so much more naive, because he's 19 and grew up as a Jehovah's Witness and was raised by, like, as you say, a white stepfather who at no point prepared him for life as a Black man. His education didn't prepare him for life as a Black man. His mother, who was Black, doesn't prepare him for life as a Black man. She herself is a victim, I think, of internalized racism, and so treats her son in a way apropos of that. So he's just never empowered to love himself or to love his Blackness. And so he finds his Blackness weaponized against him, you know, in terms of clients who want him to do particular things and want him to do favors for them that he is too naive to sort of see what actually they're trying to make him do that would actually be very dangerous to him. You know, so it's just a much more subtle kind of racism, because Jesse doesn't realize that just because they're not calling him the N-word or the Black B or whatever, you know, they're still sort of racializing him, still victimizing him because of the color of his skin. And so, you know what, it's just very, very important for us as Black writers, and I think also as Black gay men, to deal with these subjects, because we have a particular sort of viewpoint of mainstream gay culture and of white supremacy in general, white paternal supremacy in general, to show the way that some people try to get away with things and continue to get away with things. You know, look at the people who are in power on both sides of the Atlantic at the moment. And so it is just important to show examples of that in action.
We're taking a short break.
Are you a Caribbean American? Are you looking for a podcast that truly speaks to your culture and identity? Look no further than Carry On Friends, the ultimate destination for all things Caribbean American, hosted by me, Carrie Ann. Dive deep into topics such as culture, heritage, and everyday life through the unique lens of the Caribbean American experience. You'll walk away feeling more connected to your roots. Follow and listen on Apple Podcasts so you'll never miss an episode of Carry On Friends, the Caribbean American experience. Your Caribbean American community awaits.
I wanted to also speak about shame and about the internalized shame that we as queer men, you know, hold and like just hold on to. Sometimes as like a clutch, I think about Wallace and Wallace just not allowing himself to live in the way that he can because he's so ashamed of these things, right, of this past. And you think about Jesse and Jesse, you know, I just, something happens to Jesse that allows him to leave the Black country and move to London, right? So, but a large part of that is the shame. And I wanted to, you know, just hear your thoughts around like
shame as gay men, right? How we've internalized this and how it's also affected the way we participate in romantic relationships.
Paul.
Well, I guess, do you know what? Gay marriage, you know, I'm British, obviously, and, you know, gay marriage has only been legal in this country for a few years. I think since 2014 or something like that. You know, civil partnerships became legal in 2006. Before that, you know, we had Section 28 in this country where it was illegal to teach children about homosexuality and about queer issues. That wasn't repealed until 2003, when I was 21 years old. So I went through my whole sort of childhood and coming of age, if you like, with homosexuality not necessarily being illegal, but certainly not being something you would be proud of. And especially coming from a provincial part of the country, very working class, you know, growing up in a Jehovah's Witness environment where homosexuality is completely anathema. It was always a source of shame, and it was never something that I could, you know, I could never come out whilst living in the West Midlands. I had to move to London. I had to leave my family behind. I had to say to myself, you know, whether this means that I'd never see my family again or speak to them again, that may well be the case, but I'm just going to have to live the life that I lead. And so there's always going to be shame attached, but there's also a really strong aspect of desire there as well. And so there's just always this kind of tension between shame and desire sort of happening all the way through. And I think that's kind of quite common, actually. I think, you know, wherever religion plays a part in our lives. And also coming from a Jamaican background, where homosexuality, again, is considered to be, you know, what they call the white man's disease. You know, you are continually running away from the environment that made you and the environment that dictates itself to you.
Yeah, I mean... I feel like I'm in church right now. It's just, yes, I absolutely, yes, all of that. You know, I grew up on a farm and grew up in an incredibly religious and conservative family. And, you know, I was like the lead singer in the children's choir, you know, Baptist, as far back as one can possibly look, just Baptist, the whole lot of them. And, you know, I grew up with a lot of shame, and a lot of it was predicated not so much on like my queerness as like what my family perceived as like gender deviancy. You know, like if I put a towel on my head and pretended I had long, luxurious locks, I would be.
You did that too?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. You know, like. Being punished for like playing with my little cousin's dolls with my action figures. You know, two of my older cousins would call me Brenda and they would burn me with the lighter, you know, and so there was a lot of like intense, like, behavior modification going on. And clearly it worked, as I am now a homosexual novelist. It clearly worked. I mean, it was down to my mom not letting me take music lessons because she said it was what gay people did. You know, like I wasn't allowed to learn piano or do ballet or do, I couldn't even go to science camp because that's what gays did. And so gays and science, which is like very funny. Like, why was that a thing she had? And so she said that I could only do hard things, so like sports and sports. And so I had all this shame, and sometimes I think about, like, when I went to college, I met queer Black men for the first time, and I was like, oh, this is a thing. We can all be together as friends, and like, I don't have to translate or explain anything to you. And they're like, yeah, girl, get in. Like, it's fine. And I remember this one moment when going to school very near home, and my friends took time out of their busy day to drive me home so I could get my tennis racket, right? And I told them, don't stand too close to me because they'll think we're gay. And I was so anxious about my family perceiving me as gay that I was telling my friends what they could and could not do when they were doing me this incredibly generous favor of driving me, right? Like, it was just, and I thought nothing of it. I'm like, well, of course, why would you want someone to know that you're gay? And my friends had to sit me down and just be like, Brandon, like, your life is your own. You don't owe it to anybody. Like, your life very much belongs to you. Like, you don't have to live it on anyone else's terms, you know? And I was like, no, no, no. Like, if they find out, it's over for me. They're just like, no, Brandon. Like, they can't. I mean, they could kill you, but you also don't have to do what they say. You're 20 years old. And so, you know, that was a real turning point for me, like, finding other people who could sort of tell me that, like, you don't have to continue living this deep in the closet. Like, just be who you want to be. And, you know, like, when it came time to write this book, I wanted to capture that intense, almost bifurcation that happens in a life when you are someone who needs desperately to get out of whatever small definition home has for you to sort of escape into some larger sense of who you are, but still realizing that, like, just because you get into a larger definition that someone has set out for you, it's still living your life on terms set by this sort of over-cultural imagination. And that isn't freedom. It's just a different kind of bondage. And I think shame is very much the way that the over-culture teaches a people how to surveil itself and how to limit itself and how to control itself and how to restrict, you know, to restrict it. Like, it's a mode of restriction. And, you know, it sort of turns us all into these little panopticons where we do the work of surveilling our own behavior so as to not make other people uncomfortable when, you know, we should just be able to be and we should just be able to exist. And it seems obvious once you kind of crack out into the larger world, but, like, when you're in it, like, it's impossible to see your way out. Like, it's just, you know, you're telling your friends, don't stand too close to me. Otherwise people will think that I care about you.
You know, I'm just sitting here and I'm reflecting and I'm thinking, like, I'm so grateful for the internet, but I'm also grateful for writing because we're having a cross-continental conversation, right? Paul's in London, Brandon's in America, I'm in South Africa. But our experiences have largely been the same. Like, we've been carrying shame in the same way. So to think about just the manifestation of heteronormativity. But I wanted to speak a little bit about familial relationships in the book, right? We, both Jesse and Wallace, have really tumultuous relationships with their families. And I feel like in many ways it's a reflection of the precarity of queerness and how often when you are stepping into yourself, that part of your life sort of moves away because you either have parents who are like, you definitely cannot be this. Like, my child will never be that. And we sort of have two plays because religion also plays a huge role in how parents accept us and appreciate us. But I wanted to speak about what it was that you were trying to play at when you were talking about familial relationships. Because in many ways, I read it and it felt like somewhat autobiographical in some senses, right? I just like, this is too real, man, to be fiction, right? Like, this is written from experiences that people have had. So I wanted to speak a bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'll just be chaotic, but, like, something that frustrates me often is the persistence of this myth that, like, the Black Southern family is just this glorious, resplendent structure of support and love and on and on and on. Like, the hagiography of the Black Southern family just drives me up a wall to no end. And I'm just like, okay, but some of us had really difficult families. Like, we're not all just sitting on the porch drinking sweet tea, telling stories. Like, some of us have real familial trauma. Like, we can't just perpetuate this idea that the family is, like, this safe space, because for many people, that is not true for a whole host of reasons, of course. So when I was setting out to write the book, I was like, I'm going to finally tell a story about a brutal Southern family and nobody can stop me. Like, nobody can make me put in the diabetic grandmother whose foot gets cut off, and nobody can make me put in the sweet mom who, like, works six jobs and wears scrubs all the time. Like, nobody can make me put that in the book. Like, it's going to be a brutal Southern family, the likes of which I am very accustomed to. And so, like, that was really important to me, to sort of tell a story about a family that wasn't just this loving, wonderful, beautiful thing, that Wallace didn't have this idyllic rural childhood, and that his family life was complicated, and was complicated because of reasons, not just because of his queerness, but like because it's a group of people who had to work just to survive, right? Like he comes from a very working class milieu and a deeply religious milieu. And that's his point of origin. And it felt really important to sort of get some of the contours on that experience right on the page, and that it wasn't just everybody being beautiful and eccentric and lovely, that like sometimes people were really cruel and really awful. You know, that felt really important to me, that it wasn't just another beautiful Southern family, that it was brutal and difficult and messy and complicated. And I always say that I was like raised by wolves, because it was just, you know, slamming doors and nobody talking unless they were yelling about somebody stealing something. Like it was just not, it felt like there was no peace in my home. And I just don't know how to write a loving, uncomplicated family. Like, it would just never occur to me that that is what a family, like, that's what a family is. So, like, yeah, I mean, Wallace's family is kind of messed up because, you know, every family is a little messed up.
Yeah, family is only really a safe space when everyone complies, I guess, with, like, what's, you know, the central purpose. And again, you know, I guess growing up, so many of my ideas of what a black family was came from TV and from American TV. So from The Cosby Show, etc. You know, because like I grew up on, there were only two black families on my estate growing up, and we were both Jehovah's Witnesses. So there was no sort of black other around us. And, you know, I grew up in a part of the country that, until I was sort of in my early 20s, mostly voted for a neo-fascist political party, or at least they had a big stronghold in that part of the world. So my blackness was always something to be ashamed of, and my parents grew up in the same part of the world, so their blackness was always something to be ashamed of. And do you know what? Like, as third generation West Indian immigrants or Afro-Caribbean immigrants, you know, we're guinea pigs. Do you know what I mean? We don't really, you know, each generation is having to learn it, you know, who it is and identify itself afresh. You know, the second generation, I feel like my parents and their sort of cohorts were either, you know, proud of their Jamaican or Afro-Caribbean roots, but also sort of wanted to have a foot in English culture, or they wanted to just be English completely, or they wanted to be just Jamaican completely. Whereas my generation just hasn't really had that. We were born here to parents who were born here. We go to schools here. We learn the same things as other children, you know, white children. We sort of, as children, don't see ourselves as being other. Again, coming back to what we were saying before, until someone points out that we are. And so, you know, the idea that Jesse's mother is, you know, has internalized racism and is therefore treating her child like, you know, like a white woman would if she had a black teenage boy in her house, you know, that's interesting. And I, to be honest, I sort of did feel bad about presenting an abusive and emotionally abusive mother-son relationship. I didn't want to paint, you know, a stereotypical bad black mother picture. But in the end, you know, you have to be true to your material. And Rainbow Milk is a very sort of, you know, we can say it's semi-autobiographical for the purpose of marketing, but it's very, very complex in terms of how the story is dealt with and how this, you know, for example, I don't have a white stepfather, my dad is black, my parents are married, you know, so let's just clear that straight away. But you know, you have to sort of like zoom out. You know, I have the material. Like, I'm, you know, a gay black boy from a West Indian or Afro-Caribbean community, third generation in the West Midlands in the black country, who has moved to London, come out as gay and become a sex worker, having been a Jehovah's Witness. That's novel material. Like, and that's why I've written this book. But at the same time, you do have to zoom out of all of that and say, well, what am I actually dealing with? What, you know, who's reading this? What do they need to get out of it? Do they just need, like, insight into my personal life? Or do I need to tell them about the actual subjects I'm dealing with and about the people who are involved and what they've been through that has made them who they are? Do you know what I mean? And also you've got the sort of the ethical issues of writing about people who are family members and, you know, whether they've done this or done that or whatever, they are still alive. They're, you know, suffering in this world as much as anyone else is. Why am I going to put them out on a table to be shot at? It's unethical to do that. So you have to sort of come up with new ways of telling the same story, or, you know, being true to your material, but also contributing to the bigger picture.
I want to spend some time thinking about the confines of masculinity and how, like, restrictive it can be. I'm thinking particularly about Miller and about Owen, and thinking about, like, how they, in many ways, allows us to think about, like, how fucked up masculinity is, right? And how fucked up, like, compulsory heterosexuality is. Because you can't access your desires in the way that you can. And even if you do, like, it's like in secret corners or very late in your life, right? You think about Owen, who has a family, and, you know, at some point it's just like, fuck this shit, man. I'm trying to live my life. And I know I've always been this thing, but they've just not allowed me to be this thing. And you think about Miller. There are times where I wanted to slap Miller. I'm like, babes, get what you want, right? But I wanted to think about that, like, because for me, I felt like both Owen and Miller allowed us to think about, like, masculinity is really a fallacy, and it's not going to let us live our best lives.
I think with Owen, his idea of sexuality has always been mixed up with class. And he's from a working class background, but then, you know, because he sort of applied himself and the right environment, I was able to go to Cambridge University and study English with people who sort of got there less on merit, let's say, than he did. And he saw the way these people were and the way they sort of bullied and ostracized him and knew that he was gay, but really felt like he had to hold on to his working classness, and that part of that was holding on to his heterosexuality, whereas he saw other people, you know, people from more upper class backgrounds, able to indulge in their proclivities with impunity. And he just always sort of distanced himself from that. But like he says, at some point, you know, you're born whatever you end up being. It's just, you know, it's up to you whether you acknowledge and embrace that truth or not. Unfortunately, he does. But obviously not before he's married and started a family. So that sort of brings up its own issues. And so, yeah, I just wanted to have a white male character specifically in the book to address those kinds of issues and to examine his standing as a white man who is... There's a line in your book, Brandon, where you talk about a white couple pushing a stroller, and the whole world is opening up themselves for that family and for that couple because they are producing perfect white children. And that's exactly what Owen has hoped to become, the sort of person who the world opens itself up for, because he's a white man who is able to produce white children. And I guess, you know, the truth always comes out, doesn't it? So eventually. And so he, I guess, found a way to live his truth, as Jesse finds a way to live his truth. Sometimes it doesn't matter the circumstances in which you're born. You just have to sort of find your own way to be the person that you think you are.
Yeah, I mean, I think also that line you're referencing, I think Wallace then notes that he has seen that the dad of that couple on the app or something, like he's seen him on Grind.
Yeah.
which, like, happens. I mean, it happens. It's a tale as old as time. white fathers cheating on their wives with the boys from Grindr. So, like, that's, you know, anyway, yeah, I mean, masculinity is a cage, and I think often masculinity functions by restricting the vocabulary and the language people have for their experiences so that they have no choice but to just sort of like continue on as they've been programmed to. Like, it's this really strict social program. I just saw on Twitter this morning, someone shared a screenshot where this man was asking if it came off as emasculating to order dessert for yourself when you're on a date. Like, can you order dessert? Is that allowed? Are we allowed to have dessert?
This is why I came off Twitter.
I was just like, wow, no wonder straight men are so violent. They can't have dessert. They can't use nice hygiene products. They can't, you know, like they can't express themselves, etc. So like, no wonder they're often the source of so much social violence and social ill. In terms of writing Miller, you know, it felt important to me also to capture that feeling of like, you know, I went to college, and in college there were all these straight white boys who had never experienced male-male intimacy, even within the context of like a friendship. And I was often like the first other man that they had been intimate with, like in terms of like sharing experiences and emotions. And they would get so attached. They would get so attached and have all of these feelings that they didn't have words for. And they'd be like, why am I experiencing jealousy watching you talk to another friend? Like, I don't. And they would not know what to do with those feelings. And so they would treat me really poorly, you know.
Speak on it.
And so, like, I've had a lot of fraught relationships with straight white men who don't know what to do with their feelings. And, you know, Miller is someone who doesn't know what to do with the feeling of rejection he feels from the world. Like, on the one hand, you know, he's like a tall, straight, white dude. And on the other hand, he feels rejected by the world because of his family and because of, you know, the various reasons that he explains his pathology to himself. And he doesn't know what to do with that feeling of frustration and anger at what the world has withheld from him, which is essentially like approval. Although, like, how can the world be more approving of like a straight white man? And so then he encounters Wallace, who, you know, with whom he has like this very complicated and new intimacy, and he doesn't know what to do with those feelings either. And he's someone who, when he experiences a feeling he doesn't know what to do with, he lashes out, he reacts in violence. And I think that often violence and anger and frustration are the only vocabulary certain men are given by the culture that is sort of permitted. You know, it's like, I don't know how to express this feeling of complicated intimacy, so I'm just gonna go punch someone at a bar, and then I'm gonna come home, and then I'm gonna choke you a little. Like, that's the only way I know how to express my desire for you, my want for you, and my sadness at being rejected is I need to react in violence, because you aren't better than me. You don't have the power I do. So I'm going to take it back the only way I know how. And like, that is not, some people were like, I don't believe this. And I was like, friend, this required the least amount of imagining. Like, this required no imagination, because whomst amongst us hasn't had that kind of fraught, weird intimacy with like a straight white man? Like, who hasn't sort of fallen in quasi love with like a friend? I was like, the gays will know. The gays will see this, and the gays will know, because like, it's such a weird part of being, I think, like a queer man who interacts with other men, is that sometimes those other men don't have the same robust vocabulary or emotional toolkit to process like what's happening. And so you're just living your life, and then here comes a man who has feelings for you who doesn't know how to deal with it. And so he's like, I feel things for you. I'm gonna be really awful because I don't know what else to do. And it's like, you know, it's essentially just being on the playground again and having your braids pulled or getting pushed in the sand. You know, it's just, it's sad what I think masculinity does to people, and not just to men, but to everybody. Like, the way that it seeks to deprive people of a rich interior life and a vocabulary to express that interior life. Like, it's just, it can be incredibly restrictive, for sure.
Come on, speak on it. I'm like, honestly, it's like even straight black men,
yes,
they be doing this, right? I wanted to talk about sex because I think it's so important that we talk about sex. I don't think there's enough spaces for us to talk about sex. And both Real Life and Rainbow Milk had me like sort of like moving around as I'm reading. I'm like, oh, okay, okay. And so that's just to say, like, the sex scenes were absolutely beautiful, right? But also really erotic. Like, I was aroused reading these sex scenes, right? And I wanted to say thank you for that. Why was it important for you to write sex in this most ordinary way? Because I find that often our literature sort of has like a curtain. So we are introduced to the scene, but we never participate in the scene. But in both Real Life and Rainbow Milk, we really are participating in the scenes. And like also magnificently so. So I wanted to talk about sex and why it was important for both of you to write about sex in that way.
I guess it wouldn't have occurred to me to do anything else because the first novels I learned to read were romance novels. And like sex in those books, like it's just there on the page. Like romance novels be doing it. Honestly, they just, there are like nipples, there's anatomy, there's like a real like physical dimension to them when you read them. And so coming from that tradition as like a very early, like being 6 years old and learning to read from romance novels because my family had no other books, like the erotic and the sexual have always been a part of my literary imagination. But I do agree that oftentimes in queer literature, the sex scenes get all like gauzy and diaphanous and very like the lyricism sneaks in and you're suddenly like wraps, you know, you sort of issue out into the universe as like crystalline vapor. And like, I have no patience for that. When I write, I'm always thinking about the body. I'm thinking about the physicality of the characters in space. Like, I don't want to write literary character vapor. Like, I want the characters to have a physical self. And what that means is that when I write sex, I'm thinking about, okay, but like, how does that actually feel? Like, that's not a comfortable position. Like, sex is great, but it also sometimes is like really uncomfortable. Like, you're doing weird things with your body that you don't normally do. And sometimes it feels really good. And sometimes I'm, you know, like, I'm the kind of person who, like, when I'm watching a sex scene, I'm like, okay, but like, is she gonna have burns on her elbows after that? Like I'm always thinking about like, what is the one detail that makes that come to life in the imagination? And it's not often the most obvious anatomy. The parts of the sex scenes that I sort of felt the most charge in was like writing about Wallace seeing Miller's body, noting the places where his body was soft, or like noting the places where his body had hair that Wallace didn't expect there to be, you know, sort of like bringing to life those seemingly ordinary parts of our bodies that are invisible to us. We don't even think about the inside of a man's thigh unless you're like a certain kind of person, you know, like you don't think about the way that that anatomy looks. And I got sick of reading the same kinds of sex scenes where it's like doggy, or it's on the knees, or it's like missionary. And I'm just like, okay, but like, what about sex on the couch? That's a thing that people do. What about sex on the floor, in the bed? Like, how are these different? What is the sort of emotional baggage that the character is bringing to the scene that's going to make them react physically in a certain way? You know, like when Miller touches Wallace, he reacts in a certain way because of his personal history. And Miller touches Wallace with a certain hesitation because he's doing it for the first time. And I love all of that. I love bringing all of that together, the character's history, their body, and how it's all sort of talking to each other. And for me, it always starts with wanting the character's body to feel present on the page and to capture some of the human awkwardness of just existing in space.
Same, absolutely the same. The sex scenes that I've read that stick in my mind aren't the ones that are sort of lyrical and that sort of right around the perimeter of the sex. The sex scenes that stick in my mind are the ones where as little language is used as possible to describe what's going on, but you're just there. And again, it's like about the physicality and about, you know, sex, especially, you know, when you're dealing with Jesse, who is a sex worker, you're not dealing with romance, you're not dealing with love, you're not dealing with emotions at all, really. not in the act. You're dealing with the bodies, you're dealing with fluids, dealing with the way people smell, taste, you're dealing with facial expressions, you're dealing with, you know, people reaching their limits and having their limits tested. And there just isn't really an apparatus for that. You know, I could write lyrically and I could write sort of elliptically about it, but we don't have the visual apparatus particularly to deal with the vision of a 19-year-old, 20-year-old black boy fucking a 51-year-old white man. You know, we just haven't seen that in literature before. And so, you know, I just really felt like I just am a very kind of visual writer anyway, I think, generally speaking. You know, if I'm writing about food or music or the club scene or whatever, it's always going to be who's there, what are they wearing, what are they doing, what music is playing, who's rubbing up against each other, you know. And so the sex had to be the same. You know, if you're reading a book by, let's say, a straight white male author, and they're talking about having sex with a woman, we just know what that looks like. So they can sort of veer off and do something a bit more interesting than just sort of say her pussy, you know, my dick, this, that, and the other. But again, you know, because we just don't have the apparatus necessarily, or I'd never read anything before anyway in queer British black writing that showed me what it looks like, I felt like I just had to go there.
I think it would be remiss of me to stop the conversation without thinking about like what you do with the craft, right? I think a large part of both your books for me is that the craft is so beautiful. There's like prose, there's narrative shifting, first person, third person, and it's just like absolutely stunning. And also allows you to participate with the characters in the way that they want you to see their world, right? Because I felt like a lot of that Wallace, in many ways, we felt like we were journeying with him. We were watching his life. And then there were moments where we weren't watching his life. We were in his life with him. And similar to Jesse, a large part of it is we're like with Jesse. And then Jesse's also at a distance. And I thought that was like stunning. So for me, I felt like I wanted to commend you both on the craft. I thought the craft was absolutely incredible. The prose, the poetry, and also Paul, what you do with language and what you do with dialect. Like I just, the movement, it felt like music in many instances, right? Like, so you're moving in between things. And I also had the pleasure of listening to the audio book that you read. And I was like, okay, like now I really have to enjoy this book in this form. I've read it, but now I want to listen to Paul read. So I wanted to talk about that and commend you both for what really is an incredible craft. I feel like as a debut, both your books do so much with craft. And so the question I suppose I have is, I met Baldwin in both your books in different ways, right? In your book, Paul, I met him frontally because, you know, there are a lot of meditations about Baldwin. But in real life, I felt like I see Baldwin and I'm like, oh, wait, another country? Oh, wait, Giovanni's room? Like, hold up. And then I read Paul's book after, I'm like, oh, yes. This is what it is, right? So I wanted to speak about your literary influences and particularly what were some of the things that you were thinking about in writing these debuts?
So do you know what? I recently reread Tell Me How Long the Train's Been Gone for the first time since I was 20. And that was the first Baldwin book I read. And, you know, it's kind of like lesser known and less famous than the others, but I think it's one of my favorites, really. But reading it again, just a few weeks ago, I sort of realized just how much that book got inside me and stayed there. You know, in this kind of like unexplainable, unidentifiable kind of way, until you reread it, you just don't realize. You know, I followed a lot of Leo Proudhammer, the protagonist's, what he does with his life. I sort of copied almost. I sort of became an actor and, you know, I worked in restaurants. And you know, there are just so many similarities between Rainbow Milk and Tell Me How Long the Train's Been Gone that I thought were, well, I just didn't realize that there were similarities. I didn't realize that I was doing the same thing that Baldwin had done. but now reading the book, having written Rainbow Milk, I can totally see that the influence is there. You know, there's a long scene in Rainbow Milk where Jesse's working in a restaurant and you know, he's sort of giving us, you know, all the requests from customers one after another in this sort of like splurge. Baldwin does that as well in Tell Me How Long the Train's Been Gone. And I'm like, no way. I thought I was being so original. No way. I honestly did not remember that he'd done that. And I do wish that I'd read Tell Me How Long the Train's Been Gone while I was writing Rainbow, because then I would have sort of maybe come up with something different. But again, I mean, I suppose it's not a bad place to be inspired from. But in terms of craft, you know, I'm not particularly well educated. You know, I don't have a degree. I'm currently studying a degree. And, you know, I've never studied creative writing. I'm not even as well read as I should possibly be. But what I do have is I guess I just throw the kitchen sink, for want of a better phrase. I just do whatever I can in order to get the story out, to get the words out, to get the voice out. So with Norman, the Jamaican immigrant at the start of the book, who is blind and suffers unexpected racism, I was researching Jamaican flora and fauna at the British Library, and I was thinking about my paternal grandfather, who died when my dad was 2 years old, so we know very little about him, just these few little facts. And so I was just thinking about him. And after researching Jamaican flora and fauna, I went home. I was living in Brixton at the time. And I rolled a spliff, sat smoking a spliff, and recorded myself. And I started speaking in Jamaican patois, which I never do, really. And I just sort of started to inhabit this character, just telling a story about, you know, where I'd been, what my current status is, and how I feel. And I suddenly imagined that he had a couple of children, and now I'm sort of maybe talking about like how I feel the world is going to be for them, what sort of life they're going to have. And so I recorded that and then transcribed it, and that was the first draft of what you see in the first section of the book. I had no idea that that was going to be part of the book. I only added it at the last minute, but I'd written and recorded it sort of 2 years ago. And so, yeah, like I said, you just use what you've got. And I guess, you know, I have to be very, very grateful to the people in my life who help with editing and just help me to sort of focus on the storytelling and not get too bogged down in trying to write a novel. Because, you know, there's, you know, my subject matter is my subject matter, and I just have to deal with it the way that only I can, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I love that idea of writing a book that only you could write, to tell that story in a way that is like only you could do it. I mean, I think about that all the time when I'm writing, because I have this tendency to sort of want to do what people do in the books I love and admire, and I'm like, ooh, I wish I could do that, and I'm just not that kind of writer. And it's sort of, I have to like relearn that lesson every 3 months, it feels like. You know, to the question of Baldwin, I mean, Giovanni's Room, I think that's one that many people start with. That was for me too. Yeah, like the first time Baldwin was the first queer Black writer I had ever read, and it just sort of set my head on fire. I was like, oh, you can tell the truth about these things in fiction. Like, oh my goodness, like this is accessible. And then I read Another Country, and that book was just like getting hit in the stomach. It was just so incredible. And what he does, like, he's so polyphonic in that book. It's just really extraordinary. And so like Baldwin, certainly, you know, for a long time, I was like, yeah, I really, really love Baldwin, but I don't think he's like super influential on me. Like, I'm more of like a Zola stan. And then my friend Garth Greenwald was like, Brandon, you know that Baldwin loved Zola. And I'm like, oh, then this makes so much sense. Okay, I get it now. And so, it's, you know, that's sort of like, that explains so much about Giovanni's Room, that Baldwin loved Emile Zola. And, you know, so Baldwin is certainly in the water for me. Like, he writes so much about what it's like to come from like a God-haunted kind of situation, and the way that like the biblical finds its way into the very structure of his sentences. And that was something that I felt really insecure about when I was starting out writing. People would be like, what's with all this like weird archaic sounding language? And I'm like, I don't know. Like I read the Bible a lot as a child. Like I can't get it out. Like it's just a move I make. And reading Baldwin, I was like, oh, so you can do it. They were just being cruel to me. Like this register that sort of I feel really comfortable in, the kind of lyric appeal to the cosmic and to the historical and to the mythic, you know, Baldwin did it, so I can do it too. So, you know, the Baldwin influence, I feel, you know, I don't think it's there on the surface necessarily in my sentences, but I think in terms of the sensibility, like he's certainly a part of my firmament. Like I couldn't escape it even if I wanted to. You know, for me though, I think the most direct stylistic influence for me was the writer Andre Aciman. I read Call Me By Your Name as like a very impressionable 17-year-old. And I was like, oh, I want to write fiction now. I can leave this poetry thing behind and I can turn to fiction. Reading Call Me By Your Name was, you know, like that's the book that made me a fiction writer. And I think about his work all the time and I'm always trying to get close to the lyric precision of his sentences. I feel like I'm never going to get it. But in terms of real life, I think I was thinking mostly about writers of the mundane, so like Knaus Gord and Rachel Cusk and Ben Lerner, those were the writers who were most in my head at the writing of that book, because I love what they do with the mundane, and I love what they do with this perfectly lucid prose, like this prose that seems to be almost like thought itself, and so there seems to be nothing writerly about it, because it's just like thought, like it's just so clean and clear. Which is also very Baldwinian, if you really think about it. So that's what I was interested in. Writers of great lucidity and precision and who write from this place of emotion, but don't let the emotion kind of overwhelm the tenor of the prose itself. And so they were who I was thinking most about. And also Jane Austen. Like, I think about Jane Austen more than perhaps a contemporary queer artist from America should be thinking about Jane Austen, but she is never far from my mind. And the way that she writes about characters who make up their minds and then change their minds and then change their minds again, the way that she writes about people who want happiness but aren't allowing themselves to have it, you know, just like her eye as a social novelist but also a sort of documentarian of the interior life is like something I really try to embody as like a writerly ethic. I really, yeah, she's like up there for me in terms of the sort of uber novelist I always think of as being Jane Austen, but Baldwin certainly, and Knaus Gord, and you know, a whole host of writers, both lyrical and mundane.
Well, I only talked about Baldwin, but I've got like three or four others. So I definitely say Bernardine Evaristo is a huge influence on me. Her books, especially The Emperor's Babe and obviously Girl, Woman, Other, are two of my absolute faves. And I read Girl, Woman, Other while I was editing Rainbow Milk. And I just wanted to tear the whole thing up and start again. I was like, well, this is the future. So like, what am I doing? And back in sort of 2006-07, I read Proust, In Search of Lost Time, from start to finish over a 2-year period. And coming from, you know, a Bible background, this was the first time I sort of, it was almost a replacement for the Bible in terms of volume, in terms of depth, in terms of a cast of characters, in terms of just, you know, the sort of variety of human emotion that is conveyed, the variety of relationships and interaction that are conveyed, you know, queer people, you know, upper class people, you know, it was all that, you know, the great ladies of society in Paris. And so when, you know, when I write about London, I want to write about London, and I'm not saying that I've succeeded in this way at all, but I wanted to write about London in the way that Marcel would write about London and write about the people that he comes across, with this kind of sense of innocence and this sort of sense of naivety, I suppose, and artlessness. And, you know, reading him, I kind of realized that I could just go wherever I wanted and say whatever I wanted, and that it was all relevant as long as it was contextualized within someone's upbringing and, you know, who they see themselves as being and where they see themselves as going. You know, all those thoughts matter because they are part of a journey. And yeah, I think Proust, Bernardine, and Baldwin are enough for now, aren't they?
I wanted to say thank you to both. This has been a really healing conversation for me, but particularly because I don't know if you could tell, but I really immensely enjoyed both Real Life as well as Rainbow Milk. And more importantly, I think that there are books that I will often return to, because this is what I want to say to both of you. Thank you for entering us into the archive and into the canon in the way that you have. Thank you for taking up the work of talking about interior lives as if they matter. That's really what I felt when I read both books. I keep screaming to everyone. I'm just like, wait, hold up, guys. Like, y'all, these books? And those are my honest feelings. I think that what Rainbow Milk really allows us to think about is, what is the meaning of our lives, right? We are in these structures, we are in these families, but what if they are the places that don't allow us to be? What happens when we leave those spaces? Who do we become, right? And we're young, we're naive, and it's okay for us to figure out in this way. And I think that Real Life allows us to think about, the academy is not always safe, right? We think about like how often we're told that we need to stay in the academy. We need to do things in the academy. But there are certain things that that is difficult about the academy. We think about Wallace and how like Wallace is really treated like the janitor of the lab. It's just like, you can't do anything because you're this, right? And what is the cost of our lives in these spaces and why? So I think, like, honestly, thank you so much both for honestly these debuts. If you never write any other books, I will be like, thank you. But I really would implore you to write more.
Thank you so much. That's very kind and very sweet and wonderful to hear. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm just chills. Thank you for inviting me on and getting to have this wonderful conversation. I mean, I feel like I could do this forever. I feel like I made two new friends today.
Same.
Thanks for listening, everyone. Both Real Life and Rainbow Milk are available for sale at the Book Lounge. In the next episode, Terry Ann Adams and Lynthia Julius are in conversation with Chase Rees. This podcast is brought to you by our sponsor, the Heinrich Bull Foundation. The Heinrich Bull Foundation has been actively promoting the consolidation of democracy and human rights, advancing gender equality, and taking action to prevent the destruction of the environment in Southern Africa since 1989. The Foundation's work in Southern Africa consists of four programs: democracy and social justice, human rights and gender justice, sustainable development, and international politics and dialogue. Our ever-brilliant producer is Andre Burnett. As always, I'm Fasti Collins, listening with you to the Open Book podcast series.